Welcome to Leonard Lopate Weekend, where we bring you three of our favorite segments from the last week in case you missed them. You can find all of our segments on the WNYC app, our website at WNYC.org, or on iTunes. Just search for Leonard Lopate. And of course, you can also listen to us live on the radio every weekday starting at noon. On the evening of September 18, 1980, at a Titan II missile complex in Damascus, Arkansas, a worker accidentally dropped a socket, puncturing the fuel tank of an intercontinental ballistic missile that carried the most powerful nuclear warhead in our arsenal. The feverish efforts during the 9 years that followed to avoid a deadly explosion, 600 times more powerful than Hiroshima, are the subject of Command and Control, a documentary thriller directed by Robert Kenner, co-written by Eric Schlosser. It opens this Wednesday at Film Forum on West Houston Street, and it brings both Robert Kenner and Eric Schlosser back to our show. Welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
Eric, wasn't this a big news story at the time? How is it that the story of the Damascus accident is so little known now?
It was a big news story for about 3 days. And the Pentagon was very effective at denying there was any possibility of a nuclear detonation. There was a lot of other news stories. There were hostages in Iran. There was a presidential campaign. So it was forgotten. The press accepted the assertion that there was never any danger of a detonation, and we now know that was a lie.
Did they have, the press have no choice but to believe what it was being told, or did they drop the ball?
I think that during the Cold War, there was such intense secrecy around the subject of nuclear weapons that even many people within the government had no way of knowing that we had a nuclear arsenal that was nowhere near as safe as it needed to be.
Are you telling pretty much the same story that you told in your book of the same name?
Yeah, the film is based on the book, and it uses the same central narrative, but the film is much more focused. It really is a thriller, an attempt to do a nonfiction documentary, minute by minute, ticking clock thriller, and the book had that aspect to it, but it had a great deal of history and many more diversions, and I think Robbie has just really cut it down to its essence and tried to make something that's compelling from the first minute to the last.
Well, the visuals, Robert, really are kind of very compelling, yeah, to use the same word, but there are all sorts of other words like scary. Can you give us a brief synopsis of what happened?
Yeah, well, talking about the visuals for a second, we collected all the footage that one could find, and we had the Clinton Library in Arkansas helping us, and there was some footage of, obviously footage of training of the missileers, and there was some footage from out in Arkansas, and some footage from the aftermath of the accident. But I'd read Eric's book. I thought this was an amazing subject, but I wasn't sure how to turn it into a film until I found out that we had access to the only Titan II missile silo in the world, which is a museum outside of Tucson, Arizona. And we got access to the silo, and it's exactly the period that the accident took place in. So we were able to bring this accident to life.
And they were perfectly willing to have you shoot a film that is quite critical of the American military in that museum?
It took us a little while we had Air Force personnel doing interface with us, and they grew to like us. And then the woman who ran the museum was cautiously allowing us in. But by the end, she allowed us to put drones in the silo. So we actually, some of those incredible shots are a drone going up 12 stories with cameras, and it's 4 feet between the wall and the missile. And she allowed us to start to blow things up around there. And she brought her own fire trucks in and was very supportive.
I think there was also a recognition that an injustice had been done to some of the young men who served in the military. And
a few of whom died.
And really risked, I mean, it sounds so corny, but that's one of the reasons why it's such an extraordinary story. We're talking about, you know, dozens of young men in their late teens and early 20s who risked their lives to try to prevent a nuclear detonation on American soil. And the real criticism ultimately lies with some of the higher level people in the military bureaucracy who, in covering up the accident and in covering up the causes of the accident, were willing to place the blame wrongly on these young airmen who, you know, rushed. We were just talking about it earlier, but the day after 9/11, you know, I was in New York City on 9/11. I went down there and I saw the most extraordinary heroism I've ever seen of people rushing into a dangerous situation while other people were running away from it. That was exactly the same thing that was happening in Damascus, Arkansas, you know, September 18th, 1980, in which they evacuated this site, and then there were certain people who put on these special outfits to try to go into this missile silo, rescue the missile, try to prevent an explosion that could have wiped out the state and much of the eastern seaboard.
I'm talking about a new film called Command and Control, which will open at the Film Forum on West Houston Street on Wednesday with Eric Schlosser, who is the co-author. It's based on his book, and also Robert Kenner, who directed and also wrote. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You have opened up so many different things that I don't know how to follow up, but let's go back to the beginning. There are these two airmen, David F. Powell and Jeffrey L. Plum, who were performing routine maintenance on the Titan II silo. Were they experienced missile technicians? They were just kids, weren't they?
Well, you know, what's remarkable about the Cold War, and it's still true today, is the people who are doing the maintenance on our nuclear weapons and weapons systems are kids. That's how the military works. They're 22, 23, some of them can be as young as 18, and they're able to do the job because there are checklists that tell you exactly how to do each operation. In the case of that evening in Damascus, Arkansas, Powell was relatively experienced and considered quite good at his job, but Plum was essentially a trainee. He was getting what they call on-the-job training about how to service this missile. And the problem with having these sorts of young guys handling the most dangerous weapons ever made is the checklist is great until something goes wrong. And the minute that something goes wrong, there may not be a checklist to deal with the problem at all. And that was really what happened at Damascus.
Yes.
Nothing like this had ever happened before.
But that's also true of people. Age is not the factor. The fact is, once you get off the checklist, no one knows what to do.
As they stood on the platform near the top of the rocket, a socket fell from Powell's wrench, dropped 70 feet, and punctured the missile. And then a stream of highly explosive rocket fuel began pouring into the silo. Did they have any idea of what might happen as a result?
Well, as Powell said, uh-oh, when it happened. And they instantly knew. They said it was a million-to-one shot that socket could fall and hit the missile. Though when we were there, we dropped sockets numerous times, and we hit the missile six times out of 12.
Was there a fear that it might lead to an explosion that would launch the rocket, sending a nuclear warhead up into the air and landing somewhere nearby?
There was an immediate fear that there could be a massive explosion of just the fuels in the missile, and then there was the unknown what would happen to the warhead.
How powerful was the nuclear warhead?
It was the most powerful warhead that we ever built. It was 9 megatons. And by as a way of comparison, all of the explosions in the Second World War combined, including both atomic bombs, were less than 3 megatons. So this one weapon had more explosive force than all the bombs that went off during the Second World War.
And you note that it could have totally destroyed much of Arkansas and deposit lethal radioactive fallout across the whole East Coast. It also might have changed the course of American presidential history, because President Carter and a future president, Bill Clinton, were both in Little Rock, not far from the missile site.
Carter was at the White House, but Mondale
Mondale
was in Arkansas, but Bill Clinton was the governor of the state at that point. It's one of those could have been things, but it could have changed the course of history. I mean, you think what happened just after, 9/11 versus this sort of nuclear catastrophe.
It's one of these situations where they're long shots. They're very improbable. The odds of one of these missiles going off, or one of the warheads going off, rather, is very improbable. But if it does, it's one of those things where everyone's going to say, why didn't we deal with it before? And that's what made me want to go make the film, was the sense that we've stopped thinking about these missiles today. We've stopped thinking about these warheads and these incredibly powerful weapons that we have. And there's a certain amnesia that's taken over.
Well, it seems from what you say that mistakes, accidents, technical glitches are fairly common in the Defense Department. And there are a number of cases that you cite here. Didn't the Air Force lose control of a half dozen nuclear weapons for a day and a half as recently as 2007?
They did. And what was really scary about that incident is there was such a breakdown in procedures at every level. I mean, the ground crew person removing the nuclear weapons for the bunker didn't realize they were nuclear weapons. Nobody's required to sign for the nuclear weapons when they were removed. He took them past a checkpoint. Nobody checked to see if they were nuclear weapons. They were loaded onto a bomber. The pilot of the bomber is always supposed to check the munitions before taking off. And then the plane was flown halfway across the United States and left on a runway unguarded until some other workers came by and realized, oh my gosh, there are nuclear weapons on this plane. There have continued to be accidents. The most recent one was in May of 2014. There were some workers working on a Minuteman missile in a silo in Colorado, and we don't know exactly what the details were, but they did something wrong. Another team was called in, and that team significantly damaged this missile. Now, the Associated Press is suing under the Freedom of Information Act to find out what happened, but that's a significant accident 2 years ago in Colorado.
And didn't 50 Minuteman missiles go offline suddenly in 2010? Is anything being done to assure that these weapons can't be hacked?
It's a subject of enormous concern. 50 missiles, each one with a powerful nuclear warhead, suddenly went out of communication with their launch control centers. And nothing like this had happened. They traced the cause back to a single circuit board that had been improperly installed, but it raised the possibility that somebody could hack into the nuclear command and control system. Anytime an accident happens with one of these systems, you have to assume someone could also deliberately do something like that.
But even if it isn't deliberate, we're talking about very powerful weapons and we have things improperly installed. That's scary.
It's scary.
When Americans are polled about important problems facing the nation, the threat of nuclear war or a nuclear accident doesn't even come up.
Yeah, it's an invisible, it's almost like an amnesia that's taken over. When I was growing up, I remember hiding under desks to protect myself from nuclear weapons.
It wouldn't have helped, you know that.
Yes. Actually, the designers of the weapons who are in the film said that they had bomb shelters up through the 50s and then began to realize they would be much more practical as wine cellars because the bomb shelters would do no good at all. But, in the 80s, there was a large anti-nuke movement that really moved Reagan and Gorbachev to rethink it and to cut down on our weapons. But today, we just don't, we prefer not to think about it.
But you mentioned in the film, I think it's a surprise to many people, that the two presidents who did the most to cut our nuclear weapons arsenal were the two presidents Bush.
Yeah. It's incredible. The Bush Sr., George H.W. Bush, really was quite good on this issue. And when it looked like the Soviet Union was collapsing, he just unilaterally removed nuclear weapons from Europe, took our bombers off of alert, and our arsenal was cut in half while George H.W. Bush was president. And then the size was cut in half again when George W. Bush was president. And it may be one of those unfortunate things of, like, only Nixon can go to China, but both of these Republican presidents were responsible for huge cuts in our arsenal, where President Obama, who I think is wonderful on this issue and sincerely wants to abolish nuclear weapons, has had great difficulty working with Congress to continue to bring the numbers down.
My guests are Eric Schlosser, who wrote the book Command and Control, now made into a documentary by Robert Kenner. The film opens this Wednesday at the Film Forum on West Howson Street, and we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. We are back with a look at a new documentary thriller called Command and Control, directed by Robert Kenner, co-written by Eric Schlosser, who are my guests now. Can you explain the title?
Command and Control is a military phrase, and it's about the ability for a commander to tell his forces what to do and ensure that those instructions are carried out. So it's a process of not only giving an order, but being able to communicate back to the field and learn what's going on there. It's a process of command. And one of the themes of my book and of this film is the illusion of control. We create all these systems. They're ingenious systems. They're ingenious technologies. And yet someone dropping a wrench can undo it all. In the book, there's one story of a guy bringing some rubber seat cushions onto a B-52 bomber for a long flight. The seat cushions are placed next to a heat vent. The heat vent sets the cushions on fire. The bomber crashes with nuclear weapons and almost destroys one of our most important military bases. You know, when I was thinking about Robbie's film, Strangelove, you know, is sort of the dark comedy, the dark nightmare comedy about this subject. And Robbie has made a classic thriller in which some little tiny event, the dropping of a tool, sets into motion action that, you know, for the participants, they had no idea how this was going to turn out. They had no idea how to respond to the accident. And really, the bulk of Robbie's film occurs over about 9 or 10 hours in a minute by minute. I mean, the film isn't 10 hours long, but it's almost like a minute by minute examination of how people respond under pressure. Some of them do the wrong thing, and some of them are brave beyond belief.
And some of them had pretty good ideas what to do, and then were told not to do them by higher-ups.
The higher-ups had no idea what to do once we got off the checklist, as we were talking about earlier. So people really had no clue what was the right thing. But I think what's interesting is that the dropping of the socket was called a human error in the press or the Air Force the next few days afterwards. It was not the Air Force's problem. It was that someone made a mistake. But this turns out to not be the worst accident that week. There was another accident where a plane with 12 thermonuclear weapons caught on fire because someone forgot to put a little screw into where the gas comes out.
More human error.
It was called human error. The seat cushion, that was called human error. And as Eric says in the film, you know, maybe it shouldn't be called human error when someone drops a socket by mistake and throws this incredibly powerful weapon into a field.
Obviously, should have been more safety measures in place.
Well, the human error here is really building these machines in the first place.
How many were of these Titan II missile complexes were operating at the time?
We started out with 54, and there was an accident at another Titan II complex in Kansas, which knocked that one out of commission. So then there was only 53, and then the Damascus accident knocked that one out of commission, down to 52. But the missile that we had a lot of, we had about 1,000 of the Minuteman missiles, and it's a modern variant of that we have in the silos. As we're sitting here, there are about 440 Minuteman missiles scattered around Colorado, Wyoming, Nebraska, the Dakotas.
Aimed where?
Very good question. Right now, they don't have the targets in their guidance system. And if they're accidentally launched, they're supposed to just land in the ocean. But the reality is the only country we can attack with these 440 missiles is Russia, because where the silos are located and the range of these missiles, you'd either have to attack Russia or you'd have to fly over Russia to get to China, and I don't think the Russians would appreciate that. So these are a legacy of the Cold War, and
no wonder Vladimir Putin is getting involved in our election.
Yeah, well.
Although I can't imagine either of the candidates would want to send any of these missiles to Russia.
No, but there may be someone in the chain of command in one of these countries who might. And, you know, one of the central points of the book, and I think of the film, is that every one of these weapons is an accident waiting to happen.
You also include many eyewitness accounts, from the man who dropped the socket to the man who designed the warhead to the Secretary of Defense. Was it difficult getting the participants to agree to be interviewed on camera?
Well, all of these, almost everybody in the film had been interviewed by Eric, but it's harder to interview someone on camera, I think, than it is to be interviewed for a book, which is a much more casual experience.
Any of them bitter?
Well, certainly the PTS, the workers who risked their lives that night and then, in effect, got thrown out of the Air Force, were very bitter.
Because it was their fault, the Air Force said.
A combination of their fault, a combination of them being thrown into a situation that was lethal when they weren't fully aware that it was lethal. And they were, you know, the general was basically putting their lives at risk. And, you know, they were bitter about that, and they were bitter about how they were treated.
Didn't the former vice commander of the Strategic Air Command, General Lloyd Levitt, ignore your request for an interview? And should we be surprised considering how poorly SAC responded to the crisis?
Well, Eric,
I interviewed him for the book, and he didn't like it, and he threatened to sue me, and then he refused to talk to Robbie. But I hate to do this, but I'm going to give some great praise to Robbie while he's sitting here. What I do,
you need to do that.
I got to do it. What I do writing a book is I get to spend hours with people, hours with them, days with them, and then I condense it into my descriptions of them or the quote. But what Robbie has to do, and I was so impressed by it while, you know, watching him make this film, is he has to interview people while they're sitting on a set, perhaps for the first time in their lives, speaking to a camera for the first time in their lives with lights in their face, and then get them to talk about, you know, some of the most important things that have happened in their life or the most traumatic thing that has happened in their lives. And there's been a lot of discussion about this film, about how it looks, how the silo looks, and some of the early reviews have talked about how realistic the depiction of this nuclear accident is. But for me, quite honestly, the most powerful parts of the film are these interviews with these ordinary guys, again, like 9/11 responders, who risked their lives on our behalf and then were mistreated. And it's really a testament to Robbie's interviewing skill that he was able to get them to forget their surroundings and just be completely truthful in the moment. And to me, that's the core, the emotional core of the film. And I think for people who see it, that's what they're really left with, isn't these bigger public policy issues, which are important, but a very human drama of ordinary people in jeopardy and how they experience it.
And some of them, their lives were changed forever because they were hospitalized, they had terrible burns.
And terrible trauma, mental trauma. Dave Powell had really, Dave Powell never told his mother about this accident until a few weeks ago when he went with her to see the movie. So these are things that they just blocked out of their lives. And Greg Devlin, who went back on his own into that silo and was blown to smithereens that night, has been on morphine ever since. Is, you know, they all loved the Air Force. They thought that was going to be their careers, and almost all of them left the Air Force after that, soon thereafter that night.
And one of the things that the making of this film did, and look, I want lots of people to go see it. I think the film is very powerful and the subject's important, but even if none of that happens, one of the most meaningful things for me is that the making of this film provided a reason for these guys to get back together in the same place. I interviewed them separately. I went to go see them where they lived, but because of the needs of the way Robbie made the film, they flew to the same cities to be interviewed for the early screenings of the film. They showed up, and some of these guys hadn't seen one another in 30 years. Literally, some of them hadn't seen one another since the night of the accident. And the ability for these guys to get back together, and the film honors their service. And on a personal level, that was one of the most meaningful things about this experience.
Although the Pentagon claims that the United States has had only 32 nuclear weapons accidents during the Cold War, that sounds like a lot to me. You suggest that the actual number is closer to 1,000?
Through the Freedom of Information Act, I got a document that said that between 1950 and 1968, there were more than 1,000 accidents and incidents involving nuclear weapons.
And anything so like the one we're discussing here, the Damascus incident?
There were all kinds of serious accidents that don't appear on the Pentagon's official list of 32. And if you look at those 32 accidents, some of those, the official accidents, didn't even involve a warhead that was that had the nuclear material and could explode. But one of the most disturbing things is I got this big, thick document through the Freedom of Information Act, and I gave it to some of our top nuclear weapons designers who literally were responsible for the maintenance and the design of these nuclear weapons, and they had no idea that these accidents were occurring. This information had been kept from them, and it was part of the compartmentalized secrecy of the Cold War, in which the guys who were designing the weapons often didn't know how they were being handled in the field, and the guys who were handling them in the field didn't know safety issues. And that sort of intense secrecy actually made things much more dangerous.
But you mentioned in the film that the designers of the first atomic bomb worried about a nuclear detonation, the possibility that it might ignite the Earth's atmosphere and kill every living thing on the planet. But then they went ahead and tested the nuclear device anyway. Was that the most shocking thing that you discovered during your research?
Well, you know, they did the odds. They felt like the odds were against the atmosphere catching on fire. But there was one physicist who had been doing these calculations, Victor Weisskopf. He watched the detonation of the first nuclear device at Alamogordo, the Trinity test. He felt the intense heat on his face from a distance of about 10 miles. And even though he had been doing the calculations, and he was a trained physicist, he believed the Earth's atmosphere had caught on fire and everything was about to be extinguished and die. So one of the themes is this profound risk has been present from the very beginning of the atomic age, and it continues to this day, whether we're willing to admit it or discuss it, and it needs much more attention today.
As Bob Purefoy, the man in charge of safety, who Eric had shown these document, Freedom of Information documents to, who had been unaware of them, says in the film, you know, that basically our safety has been brought about by luck, and luck is a bad policy. And, you know, I thought on some levels Eric wrote a very comprehensive Command and Control is an amazing book, and it's much more comprehensive than our film. But I thought the Damascus incident is sort of the microcosm of everything that can go wrong as seen through one incident.
It's been pointed out that a small nuclear war between India and Pakistan involving about 100 weapons could kill more than a billion people. But one of the sadder moments, Harold Brown, who was Secretary of Defense at the time, said that after he learned that there had been neither an explosion nor any scattering of nuclear material, his level of attention went way down.
I think that's the scariest moment for me in the film, which is, as he said, he not only said his attention went down, he said these things happen every day. And that's a terrifying statement. And, you know, he just moved on. And as we said earlier, in fact, this was not the worst accident that week.
This is the second film that you've made together. Do you have a...
We're not talking.
You don't talk now? Are you thinking of doing another one?
We were talking about this earlier. We've now done industrial agriculture and the misuse of workers and abuse of livestock and and the threat of nuclear war. So I think great surfing beaches.
Yeah, how about Miss America pageant?
I'll leave that one to you. I think great surfing. But back, just one thing about Harold Brown. Harold Brown was unusual as Secretary of Defense in that he was a physicist and a former weapons designer. So he really understood what could go wrong. And I don't agree with him on all of his political stances, but I think he really was a public servant, and that what's been so interesting for me meeting these guys is we were all afraid of nuclear war, you know, during the 80s, during the Cold War. So were the people in charge. And the people in charge had the enormous stress of living with this knowledge and doing their jobs.
But we were making movies at the time about Dr. Strangelove, yeah. And what was the other one?
The Day After.
There were a whole bunch.
Yeah.
And now nobody thinks twice about it, even though so much of our thinking involves Iran's possible nuclear program.
Well, I mean, just getting back
and
to
very quickly, because I'm running out of time.
Okay. I was just going to say, you know, Harold Brown said when he first saw a weapon go off, he read a newspaper for, you know, a few minutes. That's how powerful it was from miles and miles, you know, 100 miles away or something.
Robert Kenner and Eric Schlosser will be doing Q&As after the 7 p.m. screenings of their film this Wednesday, Friday, and Saturday at the Film Forum. It's called Command and Control. Thank you both so much for being on our show again.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mara Wilson became famous at a very young age, starring in movies like Matilda, Mrs. Doubtfire, and the remake of Miracle on 34th Street. But coming of age in public isn't always easy, and she eventually decided to, in her words, break up with Hollywood. She explores this decision and more in a collection of essays called Where Am I Now? True Stories of Girlhood and Accidental Fame. It's published by Penguin. I'm very pleased it has brought Mara Wilson to our show today. Hello.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
Is it true that when you told your mother you wanted to act, her response was, no, you don't?
Yes,
why was she objecting to?
Well, she had done a little bit of it with, you know, she'd done a little acting in high school and in college, and she knew, you know, exactly how hard it was. And also, where we grew up in Southern California, being a child actor was a pretty common thing. And my oldest brother had done a little bit of acting, too, and he was getting burned out on it. So she knew that, you know, being me, being, you know, the sensitive kid that I was, she thought that I probably would not be able to handle the rejection.
How old were you?
I was 5.
Your mother and brothers would set up fake commercial auditions for you at home, and even when you performed your best, they would tell you you were great, but you didn't get the part.
Yeah, they did mock auditions for me, and I would just say, well, that's okay. I'll just go on another one.
How soon after your fake auditions did you get cast in Mrs. Doubtfire?
Oh, probably it was less than a year, so I must have just turned 5 at that point. And then I started going on auditions, and I was in a bunch of commercials, probably 3, 4, or 5 different commercials. And then in February of 1993, we were called for, like, it's open a call for Mrs. Doubtfire. And I remember my mom saying, like, oh, there's no way she'll get it, so let's just go anyway. And we did, and they talked to me there, and I was, you know, I was a very outgoing little kid, and I think that that's probably what got me, you know, the second audition and the third and all the callbacks.
W.C. Fields hated acting with kids.
Yeah.
What about Robin Williams?
Robin Williams loved it. He loved kids. He was so great with them, so funny, so patient, and he had kids himself, so he knew exactly what to say to make them laugh.
You write that just before he died, you had declined an offer to be in a Mrs. Doubtfire sequel, and that you worried that you might have fueled his depression.
I wondered about
that. You're feeling
that.
Guilty, even though obviously you shouldn't have?
Yeah, I think it was, you know, it was magical thinking, but I definitely did feel sad that I couldn't explain to him why. And the thing is that being a film actress just feels like too much scrutiny, too much pressure to me. And the idea of being in a Mrs. Doubtfire 2, which I couldn't quite, you know, I wasn't sure where the plot would go. I didn't know what it would be. So I had this knee-jerk response of just, no, I don't want to do this, no. And part of it was out of fear. And I wish I could have had the opportunity to explain that to him.
Had you been out of touch?
We hadn't been talking recently. Yeah, you know, I had moved a lot and he had moved, so I wasn't sure of, you know, the phone or address to call him. I'd seen him a few years earlier, and I was, you know, talking to his daughter on Twitter, but that was pretty much it.
Much of your early work was geared towards younger audiences, mm-hmm. like Mrs. Doubtfire and Miracle on 34th Street. But didn't you also have a recurring role on Melrose Place? Did your parents allow you to watch shows like that?
They would let me watch Melrose Place. At first, they would sort of fast forward through the, you know, more salacious episodes and more salacious segments of that show. But eventually, I think they thought that a lot of it was just kind of going over my head. So they would let me watch the episodes.
Was it going over your head?
Because some of it was.
Because you write about how even at a young age, you were annoyed at how both screenwriters and the media can sexualize children, bringing them into the adult world before they're ready.
Oh, yeah. It disgusted me. I had people on red carpets asking me about, you know, Hugh Grant's eliciting sex. I had people asking me, you know, who do you think the sexiest actor is here tonight? And I think they do
how
that
old
with
were
children.
You?
I was seven. And I think they do that because they think that it's funny. You know, it's funny to make children do that. It's funny to bring children into the adult world. And I really don't think it is.
I saw a clip of you on Jay Leno's show where you were in the second grade and Miracle on 34th Street had just been released. You were missing most of your front teeth.
Yeah.
And Jay started asking you if you had a boyfriend.
Every interviewer asked me that when I was a child. Every single interviewer asked me, do you have a boyfriend?
And were you uncomfortable when you were asked those kinds of things?
I was mostly just annoyed because I could tell when adults were being condescending. You know, I was old enough to understand that this was a joke, that I was a joke to them in some ways, and I did not like that.
But I would imagine when you discovered that there were doctored photos of you at the age of 12 on porno sites, that was no joke.
No, that was still one of the most horrifying experiences of my life, and it was one of these, a lot of my experiences I kind of took in stride, but that was something that really even then shattered me. And right now, when I look back on that, I think of, you know, what my parents and family had to go through hearing that, because I know that if anything like that were to happen to any of the children that I care about, you know, my nieces and nephews or, you know, children that I've worked with, I get enraged just thinking about it.
You write about how awkward it was for you to go through puberty on the set of your final children's movie, Thomas and the Magic Railroad. Was that what got you thinking that you didn't want to do kids' movies anymore?
Yeah, I wanted to grow up, you know. I wanted to do some movies for grown-ups. My family and I had always said, you know, there aren't enough good movies for children out there. So we tried to do good movies for children, and then we just started doing movies for children, even ones that weren't necessarily that good. But yeah, I didn't look like a child. Yeah, exactly. But I didn't look like a child anymore, like a little child anyway. And you know, and I wasn't going to get the roles that, you know, that people, my friends and peers were getting because I, you know, I was having an awkward adolescence and it was hard.
And when did you decide to step away from acting altogether?
I think it was kind of, it wasn't one big moment. There were a lot of little moments. I think at 13, I kind of felt like I was burned out. I still went on auditions when I was 14, 15, but I felt so uncomfortable at the auditions, and I would self-sabotage, and I didn't really want to be there, and I didn't really want to be on sets. And what I started doing instead is I started doing theater at school. I did improv comedy, I did theater, I did choir, I did all of that, and that was what I really loved. So I thought maybe what I was going to do was going to try for a career in theater. And that's when I went away to boarding school to study theater, and then I went to NYU to further study theater, and then at NYU I realized that what really interested me was writing.
Because I was wondering whether you can have kind of a normal life and still be an actor at that age. After all, you're called away from school quite often when you're shooting a movie, or did you just do it during summer vacation?
No, a lot of the kids would just get their GEDs, or they would go to special schools for, you know, professional students. A lot of my friends did that, and some of them, you know, would still go to school and then just go on auditions. I did know also a lot of kids who did that too, and it's difficult, but people out there do make it work.
Mara Wilson is my guest. As she said, she prefers to write, and she has a collection of essays called Where Am I Now? True Stories of Girlhood and Accidental Fame. you couldn't escape people judging your looks once you stepped away from acting. And you say that when you were in college, you filmed a Where Are They Now interview for television, but it never got aired because the producers felt you were too pale?
Yeah, that was really a thing. They didn't do makeup for me. They didn't think to provide makeup for me. And, you know, I was 18 and I wasn't wearing anything more than concealer, maybe. And I had glasses and I was wearing my college hoodie because I wanted to look like a normal college kid. And they just never aired it. I think they maybe aired a clip of it, but it was only to contrast me with Lindsay Lohan.
Well, did that have an impact on your sense of self-esteem? Because it's hard enough. My mother was an actor, and
yeah.
She would talk about going for an audition and feeling she nailed it, and then somebody else got the part, or sometimes she didn't feel she had done a great job and she did get the part.
Yeah.
She never understood that, but it often made her feel bad about herself.
Well, I could take the rejection in stride when I was young because it didn't really mean that much to me. It was just kind of a hobby. But as I got older, I feel like I became more and more dependent upon acting, and especially after my mother died. And now I was beginning to sort of burn out. I was beginning to feel kind of bored on sets. I wanted to explore other avenues, other things, but it was still a constant in my life. So having that constant slip away from me and having it taken away from me instead of me walking away from it felt very hard. It did feel like a rejection. And the thing about looks is I always say that Hollywood isn't immoral, it's amoral. You know, you are a number, you are your demographics, you are your looks. And so that was what I was being reduced to, and that was very hard.
You also write about your mother dying of cancer.
Mm-hmm.
How aware were you of her situation when it was happening?
I don't think I knew she was going to die.
You were filming Matilda at the time?
Yes, I was filming Matilda. I knew she was sick. I don't think I ever really believed that she would die. I don't think I really thought that she could die, you know? Mostly at that age, parents are invincible, and especially my mother. She was such a strong woman, such a force of nature that I saw it more as like, you know, my friend's parents who had diabetes or asthma, you know, something like that. Just something that she would have to live with for a while longer.
Danny DeVito and Rhea Perlman took you under their wing because they knew?
They knew. They did know. And they were very kind to me, very welcoming, letting me stay over at their house and letting me play with them. When my mother died, they provided food for, you know, the weeks afterwards, just so we were making sure we were all taken care of, because I had a big family and it was very hard and we needed somebody to take care of us, and they made sure we were okay.
What about the reality disconnect? So many scenes in Matilda are magical,
mm-hmm.
especially the scene where Matilda first discovers her powers and dances all around her parents' house. Is it true that when you were shooting it, everyone on set was dancing with you?
Yes, I was so shy. I am not a good dancer. So I was very shy about dancing.
We're not going to see you Dancing with the Stars?
No, never on Dancing with the Stars. I can embarrass myself all by myself. So I was not a very good dancer, and I went up to Danny, and I said, Danny, I'm a little worried about this scene. And he said, okay, well, the rule is on set that day, everyone has to dance. So my mom was dancing, the crew was dancing, the cameraman was dancing as much as he could. Everybody there was dancing, and it made me feel so much more comfortable, and I felt just completely secure and surrounded by love. It was wonderful.
You also write about your struggles with mental illness and OCD mm-hmm. that you've experienced throughout your life.
Yeah.
Did that cause problems when you were filming?
I think that it was exacerbated by filming. I definitely think that it was, because in filming, the priority is to, you know, get it right the first time. And I think that sort of exacerbated my perfectionism. It made me very frustrated when I couldn't get things done the first time. And it made me much more afraid of failure, which is why I think I didn't do very well in school for years. And I was always hearing, you know, you could get straight A's if you actually sat down and tried. And I didn't get straight A's until one semester in NYU. And that was when I finally did. And that was just because I really tried hard and I put a lot of effort into, you know, being organized. But for the longest time, it was just, I was so afraid of failure. I was afraid to let anybody see me act in my acting classes. I felt like I had to project this perfect image to the world. So I do think that it definitely fueled a lot of my anxieties.
Don't you now host a storytelling show about sharing fears and anxieties called What Are You Afraid Of?
Yeah, I do. And
that's a way of helping you get through?
It is. What we do is we talk about somebody's fears, usually mine, although sometimes a friend's, and then we talk to an expert on that subject. So, for example, once we talked about my sister's fear of getting water in her ears, and then we talked to my friend's dad, who's an ear, nose, and throat doctor.
Now, you've also, most of the roles you take now, because you still do work, are voiceover gigs.
Yes, I love voiceover.
Where you can't be seen. That's important?
That is very important to me. Voiceover feels like a different kind of acting, and also there's no scrutiny over looks. You know, that's another thing that I like about it. But also, I mean, I can use my voice and I can be anybody. That's the thing. I mean, if I were back into film acting, into TV acting, I would be playing a short brunette Jewish woman, whereas I can play an old woman, I can play a young girl, I can play, you know, a femme fatale, I can play an animal, you know. I just played a spider in BoJack Horseman, which was fantastic.
You have a recurring role in that show.
I do, which was really, really great. That was a wonderful opportunity for me, especially because I think it has a lot of really creative and interesting things to say about Hollywood and about child actors. It's empathetic, but it's not mocking.
The title of this book is Where Am I Now? Are you poking fun at all of those TV shows and blog posts you've had to contend with?
Yeah, definitely. I think that that's very much something that people ask, you know, oh, where is she now? What happened to her? And I also think that there's one of the major themes in the book is me trying to figure out what I am doing certain places and feeling like I shouldn't be there, I don't belong there. So it's a theme that has been occurring through my whole life.
Another is, what do you do when you're competing with Scarlett Johansson and people like that? That's an unfair situation.
It really is, you know, and it's hard. And the thing is, you know, it's inherently competitive. I also think that I was, you know, I did have female friends, but there was so much pressure there because, you know, you have to go into an audition and look at all the other girls and think, you know, I'm better than her.
There's a storytelling event launch party tonight at 8 with Mara and others, including Phoebe Robinson, at Liberty Hall at the Ace Hotel on West 29th Street. We have a link for tickets on our show page at wnyc.org/Lopate. And then tomorrow night at 7, Mara will be giving a talk, reading and taking questions, signing books at the Astoria Bookshop. Her book, Where Am I Now? True Stories of Girlhood and Accidental Fame. It's published by Penguin. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you so much. It's been an honor.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
When New York Times op-ed columnist and best-selling author Maureen Dowd began writing about presidential politics, she says she, quote, worried that the biggest story I would cover was that George Bush Sr. showered with his spaniel Millie. Now she worries about the desperate voters who are more disturbed and flummoxed than ever before by their choices in this election cycle. Her latest book, The Year of Voting Dangerously, The Derangement of American Politics, is a collection of her most incendiary takes and takedowns on what she considers to be the most bizarre and disruptive presidential race in modern history. It's published by 12, which is an imprint of Grand Central Publishing, and I'm very pleased it has brought her back to our show. Welcome back.
Thanks, Leonard.
You've been a journalist for over 4 decades, and during that time, the news cycle has changed dramatically, but wasn't there a lot of craziness in the 70s? Watergate.
The 70s was a little bit before my time in terms of covering national politics. I started with Ferraro in 84 because in those days they let women cover the woman and then they let the black reporters cover Jesse Jackson. So we all got a lot of opportunities with identity politics.
Well, but there is a lot more to deal with now. Today, for example, Newsweek published an investigative piece that claims Trump's global deals would make it impossible for him to conduct foreign policy in many countries without padding or depleting his wallet. A hack of Colin Powell's email reveals that he wrote that Trump was a national disgrace and an international pariah. There's a New York State Attorney General investigation by Eric Schneiderman into the political contributions made by Trump's charities. And, of course, there's Hillary's pneumonia and the basket of deplorables. How do you keep up?
Well, you know, this campaign is a for the first time, a fusion of politics with social media and reality TV. So things are happening so fast that Trump can give a major speech, and while we're trying to cover that, he'll send out some incendiary tweet, and that will step on the major speech. So it's like this constantly cascading waterfall of news. It is nuts. In a way, it's just adapted from the Kardashian model, which is just ruling every news cycle. I'm always amazed when I go to buy magazines and there's a Kardashian on every cover, because they know how to rule every news cycle, and so does Donald Trump.
But in this book, you are equal in your criticism of Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump.
Right. Well, this, you know, it took a long time for Times readers. I think I was one of the first columnists who didn't come from a certain ideological point of view. And I think it took a long time for Times readers. They probably haven't accepted it even now. And often I wish I were, you know, more like Frank Bruni or Paul Krugman and had my warm, fuzzy constituency who always was with me. Because it's hard, because it's kind of like, when I'm hard on Democratic presidents, all the Republicans, including my family, get mad at me, and vice versa. So, but because I was a political reporter for a long time, that's the only way I know how to do it.
We expect David Brooks to defend Republican positions. We expect Frank Bruni to defend Democrat positions. And you're trying to walk the middle line. But you've been covering the Clintons and Donald Trump since the 1990s, so you have a lot to talk about. In your introduction, which you've called Escalated to Bedlam, you write about a dinner with Hillary in May 1992. What did you think of her then?
You know, when I went back for the book and was putting together my early columns on her about when she was running as Bill Clinton's wife, and as you know, that was very turbulent for her. And I was so supportive and sympathetic to her. And I also, when she was first lady and went up to Capitol Hill and presented health care, which I had my doubts about, because the problem when you give your wife, who's not an elected official, you know, 16% of the government to be in charge of, the problem is, will anyone have the nerve to be honest with her and criticize her if she's the president's wife? But I put all that aside and put my faith in her, and I said she was dazzling, and she and Bill were doing this tango perfectly. And, you know, it was interesting because I gave her every benefit of the doubt.
But a lot of reporters were looking at her hairstyle, her clothing, asking whether she could bake chocolate chip cookies.
Yeah.
And she was saying she wanted to modernize the role of the First Lady.
Well, the First Lady is a very tricky role, and that's why I was sympathetic to her, because she was a modern woman. And I remember once during the campaign, they gave her stationery, and they had left the Rodham out of, well, you know, in Arkansas, she went through that whole thing where they thought Bill lost the governorship because she wouldn't change her name. So then she had to change it to Clinton. And then she got some stationery during the 92 campaign, and they dropped the Rodham. And she was very upset about that and sent it back. And she was very prickly about the role of First Lady, which is a very antiquated role. In the case of Bill and Hillary and the case of Barack and Michelle, they have the exact same educational credentials. So then it's very hard for the woman to go into this antiquated role of picking china and doing these small projects when the husband is in charge of dealing with China.
But didn't Eleanor Roosevelt do something similar?
Eleanor Roosevelt.
In fact, if anything, she was more political in some areas than FDR.
Yeah, Eleanor Roosevelt just ignored the niceties and bowled right through it. And she had a basket outside FDR's office that she would put all her ideas in. And Hillary tries to model herself on Eleanor Roosevelt in the sense that Eleanor Roosevelt said you have to have the skin of a rhinoceros to be in public life.
When did you first begin to have doubts about Hillary's character?
It isn't, yeah, here is my problem with Hillary. You know, I spent the weekend kind of rereading what I'd written about her and other biographies about her. And The thing about Hillary is she has always wanted to be a public servant, and she's done wonderful things. She wanted to save the world, and that part of her still exists and is great. But somewhere along the line, you know, partly through the fault of her enemies and a critical press, and partly through her own fault, she got very defensive and secretive and started making a lot of decisions from a place of fear and insecurity. So what I worry about with her is the scar damage of all these decades where she's had battle after battle after battle, and how that affects her judgment and the paranoia. And you saw that play out in the health crisis this week, where she takes a relatively mundane thing where she could just level with people, and instead there are all these misleading statements and, you know, deceptions and keeping the press behind a wall. And she has her own wall. Trump has his wall, and she has an emotional wall.
You, in reviewing her memoir, Living History, you noted that she says she learned lessons from bad decisions, but then circles back to insist that she was right all along.
Well, that is what worries me about her. She, okay, so she made mistakes with healthcare in the end. It was too secretive, and
I thought it was too complicated. Congress likes to complicate the thing. You give them a simple bill, Congress then complicates it. You give them a complicated bill, they say, I don't want to deal with it.
And it was very my way or the highway. You know, she didn't want to make the compromises, and she was kind of acting vengeful toward anyone who had any objections, and Bill Bradley and Senator Moynihan were very upset with her about that. And so if I felt like she went through these traumas and learned lessons, but she doesn't. She just keeps repeating that same pattern over and over, except the emotional wall gets higher.
You also said in your review of Living History, Living History is neither living nor history.
Well, you know, it felt like it was written by the Hillary for President algorithm.
You also have been critical about her desire to fit in and belong with the wealthiest elites. And you concluded that with, so don't miss your chance to influence a future senator or president. Call 1-800-642-GIFT to be a part of Hillary's Holiday Hall.
Well, that was a very interesting story, actually. After she had been elected senator, as she was leaving the White House, she had a couple of weeks before the Senate ethics rules kicked in. And her friends set up a thing for her at Borsheim, so Warren Buffett's store in Omaha. And a lot of Hollywood women and other donors gave $5,000 apiece so that she could choose things to furnish her Washington house. But these were things that a few days later would have been against the Senate ethics rules. So the thing with the Clintons is their whole thing since they came on the national stage was play by the rules. But then they always put themselves above the rules. And one of her top aides had a great way of expressing it, which is she's like an Episcopal minister who wants to do good, but thinks she should live at the same level as her parishioners. So, you know, it's just hard to understand her psychology sometimes. Like, she's wanted to be president her whole life. So why, and, you know, they made $150 million on speeches and books. So why make those extra two Goldman Sachs speeches for $675,000 just as you're about to run again? I mean, why does she feel so insecure about money?
My guest is Maureen Dowd. Her latest book is a collection of essays under the title The Year of Voting Dangerously, The Derangement of American Politics. A caller has called in to say that you respond honestly to politicians and aren't partisan like some of your colleagues, but the caller believes that your articles are overwhelmingly more critical of Hillary than other politicians.
I think maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm wrong about this, but I do think it's hard as a woman to write about another woman. because there is still that thing where it's kind of seen as a cat fight, you know. So, and I think, you know, the Times is considered liberal. So if I'm writing about a liberal woman, you know, it's seen as harsher. But here is my thing. Donald Trump has done many things, obviously, that are worthy of reproach. But I don't think that means that Hillary is above reproach. And I don't think it's good for her if we just say, as she said at a fundraiser recently, she's the only thing standing between us and the abyss, meaning Trump, and so she gets a free pass. I think that's a very unhealthy thing, because I watched Dick Cheney try and dismantle checks and balances, and we have to have those checks and balances. So I'm not comparing Hillary and Trump in that way. I'm just saying they both should be accountable.
Trump says she plays the woman card, and you have also said she does. What does that bother you?
Well,
is that a bad card to play?
Listen, I think that the election of Barack Obama and Hillary running has stirred up a lot of racism and sexism. And it's very painful that instead of, you know, we all felt so good when Barack Obama was elected, and now race.
Not we all. A lot of people weren't.
No, you're
to
right.
This
I'm
day,
sorry. I didn't mean
there are
mean
people
we
who
all.
Believe that he was not born in the United States and believe
no.
He's a Muslim.
You're right. I meant some of us felt very good in America to elect the first African-American president. But race relations have, you know, gotten very strained now. And so I do think a lot of racism and sexism has been stirred up by these top African American and women. But I think Barack Obama set an excellent standard when he ran, which was he never rose to the bait of calling things racism, even if they were. And I think that would be a good model for Hillary to follow. I think even, you know, when I look at a Donald Trump rally on YouTube and there's a scroll of comments next to it, the comments are so horrible and so sexist that it makes me want to go sign up for Hillary's campaign and work for her. But then I calm down and continue to be a journalist. But, you know, I just think that it's a smarter tactic for her not to play the victim.
I'm speaking with Maureen Dowd, the op-ed columnist for The New York Times, Pulitzer Prize-winning op-ed columnist for The New York Times, author of a number of books, including Bush World and Are Men Necessary? The one we are discussing is The Year of Voting Dangerously, The Derangement of American Politics. It's published by 12, and we will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Maureen Dowd. Her latest book, The Year of Voting Dangerously, The Derangement of American Politics, published by 12, which is an imprint of Grand Central Publishing. A lot of people go to Saturday Night Live and go to some of the other shows for their political news. And you have a whole section here on Saturday Night Live and the way they, in fact, it's called Parodying an Election Beyond Parody. Saturday Night Live's Lorne Michaels and Kate McKinnon dish on political humor. They've been going after both Trump and Hillary. Kate McKinnon, who is brilliant as Hillary, also is a Hillary supporter. So
right.
Does she feel uncomfortable making fun of somebody she would want to be president?
That's a great question. Well, you know, in 3 weeks during the 2008 campaign, I took off to do a Vanity Fair cover on Tina Fey when she was doing her remarkable Sarah Palin impression. And it was very interesting because when they do these impressions that actually help shape a political election, they take it very seriously, the impressionists. And Lorne Michaels thinks that the impression of W by Will Ferrell really changed the election, that helped W be more beloved and beat Al Gore.
So, it humanized him?
Yes, in some weird way. It started out
because he was making fun of him.
It did, but along the way, Will Ferrell became sort of lovable, and I think W benefited. So then Tina Fey was very afraid of that dynamic when she did Sarah Palin. She, even though her parents were Republicans and she had to get them tickets to Palin rallies, she did not want to influence the election. That's why she didn't want to appear actually on stage with her. They just did a cross. They walked past each other because she didn't want to somehow make Palin more lovable either one way or the other.
You talked to Lorne Michaels after the show and asked him whether reality in politics is not too much like satire to satirize. What did
yes,
he say?
I do think, you know, this campaign is beyond parody. I mean, Donald Trump is Tom Wolfe, when he was writing Bonfire of the Vanities, used to say that he could not keep up with the satire of that period. And I feel the same way about this campaign. You can't keep up with it. It's in the book I did a satire of what the meeting with Donald Trump and Paul Ryan must have been like, where Donald Trump, basically this 70-year-old high chair king, has hijacked the Republican Party and it's subject to his whims. And Paul Ryan had to meet with him and kind of hash this out in private in Washington. And so I did a satire of it. And then the next week I called Trump and said, describe that meeting to me. And the description was so similar to my satire that I had to start it with, this really happened. This is not a satire.
You've been covering Donald Trump since the 1990s. In fact, you were on his plane in 1999, which you say was stocked with gilt fixtures, a double bed, and French Impressionist paintings.
Fake French Impressionist paintings.
Not the real ones.
Because of the altitude.
When that's when he went on to his first presidential rope line and made his maiden foreign policy speech in Miami. Has he changed much since then?
Well, the funny thing is, you know, I said to him on that trip, why would people vote for you? You're, you know, a TV personality and a kind of almost like a Batman personality. And he said, because I got big ratings on Larry King. So even then it started the ego arithmetic. And then he began saying X number of men. At that time, he was dating Melania, but Melania was on the trip with us. And he said, X number of men want to go out with Melania. Everything was the numbers, you know, and that is how he judges everything. And that still is how he judges everything. And his name was going to be on the General Motors building X number of times. So that has not changed. But you know, his politics have changed because he used to be pro-choice and pro-gun control. But really, the thing driving him hasn't changed, which is his ideology is ego. You know, so he's a salesman. He is trying to clinch the deal in the moment.
And he was friendlier with the Clintons back then. Many people have told you that. I mean, have pointed that out, but he told you that he felt that Bill had handled the whole thing with Monica Lewinsky disgracefully. People, he said, would have been more forgiving if he'd had an affair with a really beautiful woman of sophistication.
But then he also said something nice about Monica, where he said people should leave her alone. She's been through enough. But that is one of the most fascinating things about this, that basically the races between these two New York Democrats who used to, Bill and Donald used to play golf together, and when he couldn't, after the Mark Rich pardon, when he was in kind of bad odor, he couldn't get into a golf club, and Donald Trump led him into his Westchester golf course. And at the very beginning of this cycle, I said to him, you really like Hillary Clinton, don't you? Because I knew he was about to start trashing her, and I got the impression he really liked her and has said a lot of nice things about her. But Donald Trump does not hesitate to cut all these ties and go for the jugular.
What about with you? He has banned so many journalists and newspapers from his events when they've been critical of him. He has this epic Twitter war with Joe Scarborough and with his co-host. So have you received any of his rants?
Oh, I am going to get one any minute. Probably when I walk out of this studio, I will get mine. But I haven't yet, but I'm expecting it. I'm not going to escape unscathed.
You have covered him as the short-fingered vulgarian that Spy magazine labeled him. That led to an embarrassing moment in the debates. Right. Also as a blingy playboy and as a beauty pageant and casino owner. Is there any real substance behind those descriptions?
You mean real substance in the...
Well, what is... How... is he just a reality TV star? How would you describe him ultimately?
I don't know.
Real estate mogul?
Yeah, the image that comes to mind for me of this race is Who Killed Jessica Rabbit? Because there are humans in it and there are toons in it. And to me, Donald Trump is like a toon. He's just like a larger-than-life kind of cartoon. And that's why journalists have such a hard time covering him, because he's not a normal politician. He's just, you know, he's kind of making it up as he goes along, and he's a fabulist. And, you know, he can be very charming in person and fun, but he doesn't hesitate to follow the roar of the crowd and go to dark places of bigotry if that's where the roar of the crowd is taking him. So it's all being made up as he goes along. And in the old days, I used to call political strategists to help me analyze candidates. And now I call shrinks.
Although shrinks aren't allowed by the ethics of their profession to psychoanalyze the candidates. That's been a big controversy.
No, no, they just helped me with the definition of Trump got mad at me.
Sociopath and words
like that.
Well,
Trump got mad at me because I said to him, you're a clinical narcissist. And, you know, in my experience, when politicians get in the White House and they get some horrible earth-shaking event like 9/11 and they're surrounded by sycophants, you know, actually, a lot of their gremlins can come out and they can behave in a completely different way. Like W said, he'd have a humble foreign policy, and then, you know, he made the worst stumble in foreign policy history with Iraq.
But Trump doesn't seem to be hurt by saying things like he was there on 7/11 instead of 9/11.
Because he's a toon.
He's attuned to what?
I mean, no, he's a toon. He's like a cartoon. He's like...
T-O-O-N.
Yeah, like, you know, Jessica Rabbit.
Maureen Dowd's here to talk about her book, The Year of Voting Dangerously, The Derangement of American Politics, published by 12. This is WMIC, WMIC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. He said also about him, he made monkeys out of a lot of people who had it coming, and he gleefully exposed the hypocrisy, the fundraising access, and professional political vultures. And many Democrats were very happy to see him do that until he wound up getting the nomination.
Well, in the beginning, it was kind of wickedly fun because we got to see the greedy, parasitical golden apple card of consultants and big money in politics kind of turned over. And Donald Trump was doing it out of the hip of his pocket and making Instagram ads. And, you know, that part seemed fun. But then when he opened with this burst of bigotry against Mexicans and Muslims, it wasn't really fun anymore because, you know, Muslim children were getting taunted in the schoolyard and Muslims were facing violence. And, you know, that part wasn't fun, just the beginning part. And also in the beginning when he was kind of calling the Republicans, you know, partly the Republicans have encouraged a lot of these strains of misogyny and homophobia and racism all along, but they wanted a more subtle racist. So, you know, now they're kind of shocked to see it, you know, being portrayed so blatantly.
And David Duke saying that
yes,
Trump is his man.
But Ronald Reagan started his campaign, you know, in the home of the Klan, but it's more subtle than Trump.
When your column was being published in the Saturday paper, didn't Trump say that he wanted to wait to be interviewed by you until you made it to the largest circulation of the Sunday paper?
That's so funny. You know, yeah, because everything is numbers with him. So I switched at one point to the Saturday paper, and Frank Rich was in the Sunday paper, and he would rather be interviewed by Frank Rich because he had the larger circulation. So everything is about numbers and size with him. He's all about the skyscrapers and
name dropping, because he also told you, I'm just very popular with the black populace. When Puff Daddy has a party, when Russell Simmons has a party, I'm the person they call.
I know. That was such a funny quote. Well, he was colorful and fun until the hate got into it.
So I imagine that since he has 1% of the popular vote, the black vote, according to the polls, that means Puff Daddy and Richard Simmons are the two people who are...
And Dr. Ben Carson. Yeah. And remember when he had that rally in Reading, he called out, he goes, oh, there's my African-American. He had one.
He loved being on the Howard Stern show.
Right.
And when he went on, he was a kind of a caveman in regard to women. He isn't very popular with women in the party and outside it. Can he win without getting a high percentage of the white Republican woman vote?
Well, I think that's why he and Ivanka have gone out now this week and are discussing child care and a child care program, because he's got to get that white Republican women vote. And his numbers with women and blacks and Hispanics are so bad. And he's only kind of belatedly trying to fix it. But his reputation with women is interesting. Yes, he had a lot of Rat Pack comments on the Howard Stern show. But on the other hand, he promoted this woman, Barbara Reese. He was the first real estate guy to give a woman a job at that level. And his father told him not to. So his reputation, he's always treated me very professionally. His reputation, you know, is bad in terms of a lot of things he says, but he has actually, you know, given women top jobs too.
On the other hand, I remember hearing that when he was dating Marla Maples, he would tell all of his associates, well, you haven't seen her in the nude. She's she's really hot.
No, you know.
I just can't imagine anybody saying that to
coworkers. No, it's like being transported in some time machine back to Vegas in the 50s.
Earlier this week, we had a former colleague of yours, Joseph Lelyveld, on a show to talk about his book about Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the last years in office. And he said it was unlikely that FDR could have been elected today. Would his election be impossible today, given the media attention to things like health and fitness?
This is so, it's so interesting that you brought that up, because my dad was a police detective in Washington who sometimes was part of the protective detail for presidents. And he had to transport a prisoner to West Virginia once. And when he was in West Virginia, this big beefy guy came up to him and said, we've heard some rumors down here that President Roosevelt is in a wheelchair. And if that is not true, and if that's true, I'm going to beat the hell out of you. And my dad pauses for a moment and goes, oh, no, he's not in a wheelchair. And I was thinking about that this week because, you know, you cannot get away with anything. There was a person on the street taping Hillary stumbling. And if a stranger had not taped that and put it up online, the Clinton campaign never would have told anyone about that. So we are in such a different world now. There were many parts of the country that didn't even know Roosevelt was in a wheelchair.
When people support a candidate, they just simply ignore the negatives. Trump supporters ignore an awful lot of negatives, and Hillary supporters dismiss Benghazi and the whole email thing as much ado about nothing. Are they much ado about nothing?
Well, that's why I was saying, I think, you know, just because a friend of mine, Leon Wieseltier, calls Trump a national emergency. And so a lot of people think there should be no criticism of Hillary while we deal with this national emergency. But I just think you can, you know, see all of Trump's sins, but also I think it's healthier for Hillary and for democracy if, you know, she has to be accountable too. Because, you know, Harry Truman said you never know how these people are going to take the responsibility of president until they're in the presidency. So we have to just try and ascertain, you know, their characters. And that's why I hope the book can be kind of a voting guide, because it takes these two people and also others, the Bushes, Biden, from the time when they first got on the national stage to now, because they're the two most famous people on the planet, and yet we don't really know them, Hillary and Trump. They keep trying to reintroduce themselves.
Were you surprised when Joe Biden decided not to run?
If I were Joe Biden, I would be really angry because, you know, they kind of corralled him out of the race, and Obama laid the red carpet for Hillary, his former rival, after going to all that trouble to kill the Clinton machine. You know, the Clintons and Bushes have had 28 years straight of passing this crown back and forth. And if she were to have two terms, they'd have 36, not continuously, but all together. And I think they thought Joe Biden, you know, has his gaffes and he shoots off his mouth sometimes, but compared to Trump, like, it's nothing. So I think he just basically would have walked in the White House. But now, ironically, because of the health issue, some Democrats are saying if it gets worse, she should step aside for Biden.
Maureen Dowd's latest book is The Year of Voting Dangerously, The Derangement of American Politics. It's published by 12. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you so much, Leonard.
Thanks for listening to Leonard Lopate Weekend. We'll be back live on the radio on Monday at noon. And be sure to follow us on Twitter at Leonard Lopate or at facebook.com/LeonardLopateWNYC. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.